Thank you, Andy. I appreciate the invitation to give a presentation on rice germplasm improvement. And as mentioned by Akeem, I'll focus on the aspects related to Millennium Development Goals, although that pretty much really covers all of the work on rice breeding in the tropical Asian scenario. So that's the general focus of my presentation. And I'd like to start by just mentioning that rice breeding has been very successful in terms of developing improved varieties that have met the requirements of the farmers in the developing areas of Asia. Most of the traditional varieties have been replaced by modern high-yielding semi-dwarfs. Certainly there are exceptions, and particularly in some of the less favorable areas for production, there are still traditional varieties grown, but in most cases in Asia, the traditional varieties have been replaced by modern high-yielding varieties, and this has occurred also even in the rain-fed lowland areas, particularly in the more favorable rain-fed lowland areas where modern varieties have spread over the last 10 to 20 years. These varieties have been improved for many traits, of course, yield potential being perhaps the most important, but also in grain quality, disease and insect resistance, and other agronomic traits that have been useful to farmers. These modern varieties, starting from IR8, which was the first high-yielding variety released by Erie, have been very essential in staving off famine in Asia, and it's estimated that if the rice yields were the same today as they were in 1965, there would be a need for an additional 135 million hectares of land to meet the requirements of the population that depends on rice. I feel that although we have new tools for rice breeding, the breeding of rice will continue to depend on the time-honored methods of breeding, including hybridization, and also the need to grow large breeding nurseries as we have in the past. Some of the new tools will allow us to be more precise and focus on particular genes to introduce into varieties, and so that does in fact reduce some of the requirements in terms of area, but I still think for the foreseeable future that we will be growing the large breeding nurseries as we have in the past. And of course, rice breeding is a combination of both science and art, and of course it doesn't hurt to have a bit of luck. Maybe many of the breeders don't like to admit that they need this luck, but on the other hand, if they aren't successful, they could blame that on bad luck. So these are some of the areas I would like to cover, really the focus on increasing yields, improving grain quality and nutrition, disease and insect resistance, and abiotic stress tolerance. And I will be mentioning some of the opportunities for the new tools that we now have for breeding and some of the approaches that can be used as a basis for exploiting some of these new tools. So just to start with yield, the yield potential achieved by the semi-dwarfs, I think in the 1960s, has really been difficult to exceed in terms of breeding to improve yield potential. Of course, there's been a lot of improvement in terms of rice varieties, particularly in terms of grain quality, insect and disease resistance, and also in terms of reducing the time, the growth duration of the crop, but in terms of actually increasing yield potential above these original semi-dwarfs, it's been very difficult to really go significantly beyond that. I think one of the approaches that has really been successful in doing that is in hybrid rice, and this has been, of course, very successful in China. It's probably been less successful in the tropics. However, I think we're starting to see the change of that now. We're seeing quite a bit of spread of hybrid rice in countries like India and Vietnam, and we'll probably see spread in other countries. And I think some of the recent results from some of the hybrid breeding programs indicate that they're getting quite good yield improvement now. There are still quite a few issues for improving hybrid rice and making it more available to a large number of farmers. For one thing, we don't really have a good understanding of the heterotic pools needed to attain the highest yields with the hybrids. There are still limitations in terms of seed production. This depends really on the parents used for hybrid rice production. What they've done in China is to breed for parental combinations that have very good seed production in terms of producing the F1 seed, and this makes it more economical to produce the hybrid rice seed. In the Asian hybrid rice, the seed production is still quite a bit of limitation, and that's why for many farmers the price of the seed is still a bit high. And then finally, we also need a more reliable two-line hybrid rice system. The two-line hybrid rice depends on photoperiod or thermosensitive genetic male sterility. And so by using this kind of sterility, we can eliminate the need for restorer lines that's required with the three-line CMS system. And so I think that in the future, we'll see a lot more use of this two-line hybrid rice system, which makes it much easier to exploit a large number of varieties in terms of producing hybrids, new hybrids. Now, I mentioned about the problem of significantly increasing yield, and I don't want to give the impression that there hasn't been any progress. There has been progress, and there's been a lot of new varieties developed, and this is just a sample of some of the lines from Erie that are showing good performance and much better performance than the some of the previous varieties that have been the high yielders in Erie. And many of these varieties are also being released and adopted by farmers. So if you look today at the varieties being grown as in the Philippines, as an example, almost all of them are the newer varieties that have been released during the last 10 years. And so we have seen quite a bit of improvement in varieties. In many cases, the improvement is not only a matter of yield potential, but is also in traits such as disease and insect resistance and grain quality. One of the approaches that we're looking at for, that we have been looking at for increasing yield potential is to use a new plant type. And this plant type is based on the japonica type, tropical japonica type, as opposed to the traditional kind of indica rice that's been used in rice breeding in Asia. With the indica varieties, they are quite high yielding, but they also have a very high tillering rate, and many of those tillers don't produce panicles. And so there's a feeling that this is kind of wasteful, and that in order to achieve higher level of production, we should minimize the production of these unproductive tillers. And so this was one of the rationale for using this new plant type model. And there has been some success in this. Some of the japonica new plant types were released in Yunnan province in China and were very high yielding there. However, in the tropics, these really did not have much impact, and they were not very high yielding compared to the standard indica varieties. More recently, there have been crosses made between the high-yielding indica varieties and the new plant type japonica varieties, and these have resulted in what we call the improved new plant type, which is really closer to the original indica. And I think from this kind of program, we're getting much more progress in terms of improving yields. And in fact, this year was the first release of one of these new plant type varieties in the Philippines. And so I'm hoping that although certainly this new plant type project wasn't as successful as people had thought it would be when it was started in the early 90s, I think it is generating a lot of very useful germplasm that can be the basis not only of new inbred varieties, but also in terms of the potential for hybrid rice, because these do have quite a bit diversity of germplasm. They represent a new kind of gene pool that we can exploit for achieving higher levels of heterosis. Now, I mentioned hybrid rice, and I think recently we've been getting some very good results, very high yields of the hybrids in the Philippines and other locations. And so I think that in favorable environments, it looks like a very good strategy. But I also wanted to mention from this slide that even in the less favorable environments, the hybrids seem to have very good yield potential and very good performance. And in this particular slide, you can see on this axis the yield and the non-stress. And this excess yield in the stress, and we're finding that some of the hybrids are quite good under a broad range of conditions. And in fact, some of the experiments that have been done under drought-prone lowland conditions, or even under what we call aerobic rice condition, which is a kind of favorable upland condition, the hybrids have done very well. And so, in fact, it seems like their advantage is actually higher in some of these stressed environments. So we're quite excited about the potential of using hybrid rice in some of the less favorable lowland situations. Now, grain quality is another very important factor for rice improvement. And in fact, if you don't, if you're not able to meet the requirements for grain quality, then it's unlikely that any variety would be adopted. And I just made a list of some of the key traits that are required for having improved rice varieties. Size and shape are extremely important. Those are the first things that consumers usually look for. And there are, of course, many regional preferences. In the tropics, most of the consumers like slender grains, but there are exceptions to that. Translucency and whiteness, all these appearance factors are really the first things that the consumers look at when they purchase rice. Texture, of course, is the main cooking quality requirement, and this is usually determined by amylose content. Fragrance and taste, fragrance in particular are important for export or for the premium quality market. And satiety is a kind of trait which we term when a particular variety has a kind of filling characteristic to the people. And for example, you would find if you go to Bangladesh that the people who actually do labor, physical labor, they have actually different preference of rice, and they like a rice that really will stay with them the whole day long. And so it's a trait which I can't really explain to you what the characteristic is, but it's a very real trait. And in fact, there are varieties that are very popular because of this very reason. I mentioned there are local preferences, and also there are farmers that will grow a different variety for their own home consumption compared to what they would grow to sell to the market. So there's quite a diversity of requirements, but what our objective is at Erie really is to try to really meet what is the requirement for a variety to be successful. And I think you will find that some of the very successful varieties are actually successful because of more because of quality traits than because of something like yield or disease resistance. And we don't put a lot of attention at Erie on premium quality. This deals with mostly varieties like basmati and Thai jasmine and so forth. But they are very important in those particular countries in terms of the export market. Now, nutritional improvement is another characteristic that's been recently considered an important trait. And this just shows some of the progress that we've made in terms of improving the iron and zinc content of rice. IR64 would be an example of a variety with a typical indica variety with low levels of iron and zinc. And IR68144 is one of the first varieties identified that had elevated levels, but still a little bit low. But if you look at some of the recent varieties that have been developed, you can see we're getting quite high levels of iron. And we call this at the intermediate level, a target level for iron content. And so we're hoping to raise this further in terms of helping to alleviate micronutrient deficiencies in rice-eating, which is a very common problem for rice-eating populations. Zinc has actually been more successful, and one of the reasons for this is the zinc content tends to be concentrated more in the endosperm, whereas the iron tends to be concentrated more in the outer layers, and many of these outer layers are removed during the milling process of the rice. Vitamin A is another project that we have at Erie with golden rice, the transgenic golden rice. And I think this project is going very well. This the genes for golden rice are being introduced into the widely grown varieties. And I'm hopeful that within 3 to 5 years, we'll see some of these being tested and hopefully released to farmers in Asia. And now we have quite good levels of beta-carotene in these varieties, and I think they will have a very significant contribution to this particular problem. And what has been observed so far is that it seems like the farmers themselves do not really have any major kind of concern about the use of golden rice. Disease and insect resistance has been very successful for some organisms. Gall midge and tumor virus are good examples, and bacterial blight. These are diseases or insects where we've had some good success in terms of resistant varieties that have been successful in the farmers' fields. In some cases, the disease resistance has been short-lived. An example is blast. Breeding for major genes for blast resistance, they haven't been very, very durable, and so most of them break down quickly. But one way to get around that is to focus more on the partial resistance, which is usually not controlled by major genes, And if you select for this partial type of resistance, then the varieties tend to do fairly well under the tropical lowland situation. Brown plant harbor has also been a problem, and it seems that the insects can actually adapt to brown plant harbor resistance genes, and so this has been difficult in terms of getting varieties that have been resistant to brown plant harbor. I think there's been a kind of drop-off in interest of breeding for BPH resistance, but I think that was probably a mistake, as we could see from some very serious outbreaks of brown plant harbor in the last couple of years in East Asia. So I think there's going to have to be a renewed effort on brown plant harbor. There's been many genetic studies for major genes, and in fact, quite a large number identified for diseases like blast and bacterial blight. For blight, many of these have been quite successful and used in breeding lines and varieties. For blast, again, because of the problem of durability, people have started to focus on trying to pyramid different genes to get more durable resistance. These are just some examples of the many genes for insect resistance that have been identified. And I have to say that most of these genes have not been used really in practical breeding programs. I think gall midge is one exception, where there have been a lot of gall midge resistant varieties developed in India and have done quite well there and worked very well. And one of the recent successes we've had is on Tungro. Most of the original varieties that were resistant to Tungro were actually resistant to the vector for Tungro, which is a green leafhopper. But recently, we've been able to transfer the resistance for the virus itself from many sources, including from some of the wild species. You can see Oryza rufipogon here. And these varieties are resistant to the virus, and they seem to be quite stable, producing very well in areas where Tungro is a problem. Okay, so now I'd like to focus on abiotic stress, and these are some of the stresses that we can focus on. I'm going to talk mostly about the first three, drought, submergence, and salinity, which are the main ones that we work on at Erie. We do also have some work on low temperature, and we're going to be starting more work on high temperature in relation to climate change. There have been recent advances in abiotic stress, and I think this has made the situation very promising for developing improved abiotic stress tolerance. One of these is the improved ability to accurately measure the phenotypes of the tolerant varieties. Genetic analysis and identification of large QTLs, quantitative trait loci. This widespread adoption of mega varieties in the rainfed areas has actually given us an opportunity to focus on these particular mega varieties in terms of improving stress tolerance. And this is mainly because most of these mega varieties are actually very susceptible to abiotic stresses. And so we do have sources of abiotic stress tolerance that can be introduced into some of these varieties. And because of this, we can use the MAB molecular-assisted breeding, or actually what I mean here is a marker-assisted backcrossing approach to introduce these genes into improved varieties. This just outlines the approach that we've used at Erie for introducing major QTLs into widely grown varieties. And so we go through a process where, in fact, within two backcrosses, we can transfer just a small segment. We do this by a combination of target gene selection. In this case, I'm using a hypothetical example of a gene on chromosome 12. And then we also use recombinant selection, which means that we select for recombination on either side of the gene so that we end up with a very small segment. And I'll mention why we do this later. But what we end up with is a variety that looks like actually the recurrent parent, in this case a widely grown variety, and only has a very small introduction of the target gene. So this means that the variety will, in effect, behave very closely to this variety, except for the genes that are in this region. And that's mainly the target gene that we are trying to introduce. So an example of this is the development of Swarna sub 1. Swarna is a variety that's very widely grown in India and also in northern Bangladesh. It's estimated to be grown on something like 6 million hectares of rice. And we introduced the sub 1 gene by the process that I mentioned. They look almost identical. In fact, performance, yield performance and other characteristics are the same in these two varieties. The one trait that's visibly different is the color of the hull. Swarna sub 1 has a lighter colored hull. That is because of a gene that's linked to the sub 1 gene, closely linked to the sub 1 gene on chromosome 9. This one has a kind of a gold colored hull. You could see the performance under normal conditions, very similar under submerged conditions. Swarna is heavily damaged, whereas Swarna sub 1 is doing very well. This is the slide that Akeem showed. And you could see the effect of sub 1 under 17 days submergence. And in terms of yields, of course, it's quite amazing yield improvement, I guess. It's unbelievable. It's hard to believe that you could get that kind of improvement of yield just by this gene. But if you look at Samba Mashuri, under submergence, 0.58 tons, Samba sub 1, 4.37 tons. So, yeah, it's worth using, I think. We also made a movie of this, a time-lapse video. So I don't have time to show you this movie, but I actually would prefer that if you want to see this movie, go to YouTube and type this in, and that will improve our ratings. We're still pretty low. We're not right up there at the top with the YouTube, but you know, I'm hoping we'll get there. So you could see a time lapse going from just before transplanting to near the harvest time. But this is a middle shot which shows you the big effect of the sub 1 gene. that doesn't go in my list of publications, no. So I want to mention that, we were lucky because sub 1 is such a big effect and it's a nice QTL. It's a nice major gene, in fact. But we do have other genes coming along which look like they could be very promising. And I just made a list of some of the QTLs that seem to have very, very large effect. And so some of these we're already starting to work on in the same kind of manner. Even if you don't get such a big dramatic effect as a gene like sub 1, you can still make quite useful progress in improving these fruit varieties. I want to mention something about drought, because drought's always been considered too complicated. And I just want to show you some of the varieties that have recently been developed for drought tolerance. And just look at the yields under severe drought stress compared to the two widely grown varieties in this area. This is done in India. This is from a network in India to evaluate drought tolerance. So you could see the effect of drought tolerance in terms of the performance of these varieties. And so I think that we're making some very good progress on drought. And these are some of the QTLs identified for drought tolerance. And we still have a ways to go to fine map these. But I think these will come along very well. This is actually some of the work of Gary Atlin, who was here today, and his successors at Erie, who are really, I think we're moving quite far on drought tolerance. Now, one of the advantages of the process I mentioned about minimizing integration is that by doing this, you minimize the amount of donor DNA coming through to the variety with the gene you're introducing. If you don't use the recombinant selection, you end up introducing a very large amount of donor DNA, 15 megabase. And so this would be compounded if you're introducing multiple genes. I think it's important because if you introduce three or four genes by this process and you don't use this recombinant selection, then you're going to end up with a lot of genes coming in which will change the behavior. And right now we're working on things like QTL pyramiding, where we're trying to introduce sub 1 and bacterial blight resistance into the same variety. So by minimizing that introduction along with the sub 1 gene, we can make sure that what we come out with will meet the farmer's requirements. These are some of the targets that we're now focusing on, developing varieties with submergence tolerance and salinity tolerance. I was able to see some experiments to test for salinity a couple months ago in India, and all of them were destroyed by submergence. So it really helps to have these kind of combinations. These are some of the other traits. Finally, I'd just like to mention about one of the reasons we're focusing on abiotic stresses. If you look at these red parts of the circles, they are, in fact, the rain-fed areas. And these rain-fed areas are scattered here in the areas where abiotic stresses and where poverty is important. And so that's one of the main reasons that we focus on this. I think I can skip that and just end by just saying that one of the things that's been very successful at areas in using wild species. I just wanted to highlight the work of my colleague, Dr. Darshan Brar, who has also won an award of Outstanding CG Scientist this year. And he's done some really outstanding work in terms of making genes available from wild species transferred into improved rice varieties. So just my final slide, a 17-ton rice field in Yunnan, China. And this is a 1-ton rice field, I'm being generous, in Mozambique. And I think we can make progress across the whole range. I think it may be actually difficult to make progress in terms of breeding for higher yield here, but in terms of this kind of condition, with breeding and with improved management, I think we can make a very significant contribution. And the 1 to 2 tons extra we get here would make a huge difference if you think of a farmer now getting 1 ton per hectare. Thank you very much.